You're listening to a podcast of spurious morality. Hooray, marvellous.
Hello and welcome to a podcast of Spurious Morality. This week we are going to start looking back at the current era of Doctor Who. So that's going from the Star Beast onwards when Russell T Davies came back to the show. And we're going to split this up over three episodes, starting off this week with a look at the 60th anniversary episodes. We have looked at these before, but we are changing up the people we've got on the podcast, and also time has passed, so some of our thoughts about these episodes might have changed over the years as well. So today you have Mark.
Hello.
And you have myself. And like I said, we're going to start off by talking about the 360th anniversary episodes featuring David Tennant and Catherine Tate returning to Doctor Who. But before that, we'll start off by going back to before they were broadcast. And I was struggling to remember some of this myself, but like, what was it like in that period of anticipation before they actually were broadcast? Like, Mark, do you remember anything about the announcement and the rumours?
And it was, oddly enough, the timing was incredibly close. It was almost to the day. It was September the something. I remember the 2003 announcement that Doctor Who was coming back. That was September 23rd, if I remember rightly. And this thing came in just a day or so either side of that, on whatever that anniversary in 2022 would have been. So the timing felt very on point, but it was also just incredibly exciting because this news just came out of the blue. I don't think anybody was expecting it. It was just like one minute was not known about, the next it was on the BBC website and people were kind of going mad for it. Like, I think it's fair to say that despite anticipation around Jodie Whittaker's finale and the return of, you know, 80s companions, which I know you and I are very excited about, and all of that stuff, I think the overall feeling of the Chibnall era was something of Doctor Who hitting the doldrums for a little while and not quite, you know, kind of losing its mojo a bit. And just this idea of Russell T Davies suddenly being back, it was like, you know, the second coming, no pun intended, and there he was, and he was going to inject this thing with a whole new lease of life. And you could imagine that he's not the sort of guy that would just come back and regurgitate his old stuff. He would come back having ingested the last lot of years of television and even bring his own evolution in writing from things like Years and Years back to, which I think you do see splashes of in RTD2. So yeah, I remember much excitement from well in advance and just thinking, gosh, what is this going to be like? And then there was rumors of Disney money coming in. I can't remember at what point that was confirmed, but it was this big build of anticipation. And he was saying quite early on, I think he was talking about scripts he'd already written for not the specials, but further down the line. And he was saying, we've never written stuff like this before, or I've never written stuff like this before. The show's never done stuff like this before. We're going into whole new areas. Now, that led my brain down certain paths that ultimately weren't fulfilled. But that's not to say that what we didn't get didn't impress me, because it did. It was just different to what it led me to believe in terms of how radically different it would be. But yeah, that's kind of my little stream of consciousness on that.
I remember. Yeah, I was trying to think back and think like what the sequence was of like when we found out. So I think there was rumors about this floating about well before the official announcement, and then the stuff about Disney, it sort of came out slowly as well, and there was a bit of confusion at first of, oh, are they just a distributor or are they actually involved in funding and co-production, and if that's the case, how much creative control do they have? I feel like some of that came out over time.
You're right. There was a lot of speculation over many of the podcasts, ours and others, about that. So, it was at forums and things. So there was a lot of unknowns, but it was certainly provided a lot of talking point while we waited for it to. we waited with more impatience than anything for the thing to come along. You know. Because it obviously takes time to put these things. But then it seemed to be barely no time at all before we were seeing, would that have been, when were we seeing footage of Bernard Cribbins and Catherine Tate and David Tennant?
Well, there was leaked sets, quite early on, and then,
So, I don't know, it seemed to be this simultaneously torturously long wait, but also... Yeah. Stuff seemed to be also happening very fast as well, and it was just a blur of, you know, that was the thing. I think it was this feeling of the Chibnall era, fairly or unfairly, garnered itself a reputation as something that would just, you know, it became almost a running joke that, you know, the most publicity you would get before a season would be them taking the website down or putting one or two little still images from Legend of the Sea Devils out or something, and then all of a sudden there was this sort of. When we're back to the era of Russell T Davis dropping heavy hints early about forthcoming things, and the whole it was felt like a big sea change, you know, possibly more than it actually was. But he's a very good.
I felt that.
Man, and, on the front? Yeah. So
and even the change from Russell T Davis to Moffat first time around, Moffat you'd see him in press stuff a lot, but like Russell T Davis was kind of definitely like the most effusive and like active, I think, with engaging with the press. Just thinking about how I reacted to it, I was excited. I remember this sort of expectation or assumption I had was, okay, cool, this is going to be a sort of nostalgic look back with an old doctor coming back, and there's a sort of running joke about how, like, regardless who's the current doctor, David Tennant is often, you know, the one that you see on merchandise and games and things, and but he's very welcome because he's a very good doctor. So, you know, I always look forward to him when he's on Big Finish stuff. But I was sort of happy with that, of like, okay, we're going to do like a finite nostalgic look back, round off Donna's story, which was has some potential there. And then I thought, okay, then they're going to just go in like a very sort of radically different direction after that. Because, again, like you said, with, you know, Russell T Davies has done a load of other stuff, years and years, and loads of other dramas. And he himself was talking about how he's not going to come back and do the same thing. So maybe we'll get into that more in next week's episode and see like how much of that panned out with the 2024 season. Hmm. But that was my thought. I was going into it like, I think, like a lot of fans, very sort of energized and enthusiastic, and I think overall it met my expectations. But before we jump into looking at the specific episodes, the three episodes we're looking at here are The Star Beast, Wild Blue Yonder, and The Giggle, all broadcast during the 60th anniversary year, 2023. But The Star Beast was interesting in that it was a adaptation of a very old comic strip, which had also been adapted into a Big Finish story. So, first question, like, what were your thoughts about the fact that they were adapting this quite well-known, well-regarded comic story?
That is one of my least favorite bits of news to hear is when they say we're going to cannibalize this existing thing that is already well loved, and we're going to sort of arguably overwrite the long-standing thing with a thing that sort of now belongs to the prime canon or whatever, you know. Now, I'm somebody who tries to be as generous in what I include within my head canon as possible. So I will do mental somersaults to make sure that, for instance, human nature really does happen twice to the Doctor and stuff like that. You know? And so when I saw that, I thought, oh, no, this is the one that's going to annoy me most, just the fact that it is taking something. And unless the Doctor shows recognition of the Meep, as we now call it, Beep the Meep, as we were calling it back then, them, sorry, to use the proper pronoun. I don't know. I just thought chances are it's going to be like as though the Doctor's meeting the Meep for the first time. I'm going to have to, you know, fall back on that final contingency of, oh, the Time War did this or whatever, you know. So that kind of thing bugged me a wee bit. But I realized that it's Russell T. Davis doing that thing. He has form in this regard. So it's not like he hasn't basically done a sort of a redo of Spearhead, you know, in Rose, just to have something reliably iconic against which to play out the new foreground elements.
Yeah.
And I know he also did, for instance, yeah, I mean, I referenced Human Nature there before, and we've had a Rob Sherman story, which in my opinion was so radically altered, it basically is two stories anyway. You know, there's no problem accommodating those in one.
That's Jubilee being, I mean, Terry Nation told the same Dalek story several times in the classic series. If you think that Jubilee and Dalek are the same story, then
the other little bit of, you know, the other little thing that sneaks in a wee bit more under the radar is, and it slightly treads on the toes of a bit of expanded universe stuff, and it's a story that I particularly love. It's one of my all-time favorite big finishes. Yeah, the other one that kind of snuck in as part of a little bit of expanded universe stuff was Isaac Newton coming into the pre-title sequence of Wild Blue Yonder. And, you know, that one's easier to reconcile for me. I can sort of imagine, okay, he doesn't look like David Warner, but maybe he put 30 years on him and his voice ages up and he becomes more curmudgeonly, and you know, there you go, there's your circular time David Warner, and you can just about squint and make that thing about the apples hitting him full in the face work, you know, that Peter Davison references in that story. He says, oh well, I'm a very fast bowler, but you can sort of say, okay, well, that's him guessing or intuiting that he was the guy responsible, and he doesn't know yet what form that fast bowling took, but maybe it was via TARDIS after all, you know. Anyway, sorry, that's my other little expanded universe niggle that came in. And was like, don't ruin circular time. Just tread carefully there. But they just about got away with not absolutely overriding it or anything. So but the Star Beast was the main. But you were asking sort of in terms of the main, I guess the main sort of story beats and stuff there. I think it pulled in a fair bit of the iconic stuff from the comic. The look of the Meep was very much just ripped from the pages of Doctor Who magazine. And that ship looks pretty much as you see it in the comic strip too. A lot of other stuff. I mean, there's nods to like Fudge, who was a main player in the comic strip. It's just a sidelined observer in the TV one and stuff like that. So it's, I guess the Time War got involved yet again and rewrote something there. And either that or the Doctor's been mind wiped a few times in the interim. Whatever it is, anyway, this is happening in a new form. And actually, one thing it sort of seeded in my mind was it took me down for a long time. I started going down this breadcrumb trail of thinking that the series was going to do something really, really, really out there. I'll talk about this more next week because I think more of the apparent clues, which weren't really clues in the end, jumped out at me from the main series. But I thought they were going down the line of saying Doctor Who will turn out to be a TV series, and the Doctor will find that he's in this TV series, and that will be the finale of Intuity's first season. And when that didn't turn out to be the case, I was a bit initially disappointed, but that's my own fault for building up a whole theory in my head. It wasn't, you know, seeing patterns and things that weren't there, you know. But that seemed the seed of that maybe came from watching the Star Beast and thinking, is he sort of suggesting that, you know, the Doctor Who multiverse is pulling in things from all its different media? And, you know, I don't know. I'm not saying it very coherently, and I might explain myself better next week when the more pertinent examples come up. But,
Yeah, and as I understand it, there are 26 episodes of Doctor Who that have been ordered as part of this Disney deal, so where 13 of those have been broadcast. Mm-hmm. So it might be that some of the clues and seeds that we've seen so far have yet to actually be developed and be revealed to be significant. Like the stuff, again, if we go on to like talking about more about the Star Beast, there's things about the Meep's boss. Is his boss in common with Rogues? Is that something?
I did wonder that when it was mentioned in Rogue. It seemed too big a coincidence, you know, that new boss he refers to, doesn't he? And it's like, yeah. It feels almost conspicuously throwaway, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
That one's... Well,
Yeah, so there's definitely, I think, more foreshadowing to be paid off. But, I mean, starting at the start of the Star Beast, we have this recap, this intro, where you have some narration from the Doctor and from Donna. And as I understand it, that wasn't part of the original script and the original production. It was added on afterwards. And it's not awful, but I think it shows that it was sort of bolted on to the start. What did you make of that, those first couple of shots?
I noticed that Rachel Talalay has come out in recent times, like just in the last month or two, and sort of very explicitly said that was not me. It doesn't bug me the way some other people think it's a complete travesty, and I don't see it that quite like that. But it does feel very grafted on. You can tell it's a sort of a bit of a Disney had a word afterwards and said, "Look, can you do this as sort of a bit of a, I don't know, just a little bit of an additional punching up of the bullet points here, you know?" And I think Russell T. Davis likes to, his general tendency seems to be towards, he does a first episode and there's no cold open or pre-title sequence or whatever you want to call it, and he just goes straight into the titles, especially if they're new ones, to sort of grandstand those. And those titles are beautiful, by the way. Well, I think they are. I think they're the best ones we've had since the series came back, and the version of the theme too. In this case, it seems like that's what he had in mind, and Disney possibly had a little word and said, "Could we have just something to?" It's not quite in the realms of the Paul McGann voiceover at the start of the TVM, but it's sort of nudging into that kind of arena, isn't it?
Yeah, a little bit. I was wondering that. Like, you know, it's there to help new viewers along, but how disorientated might they be if they've never seen Doctor Who before? I think it's fine. The bit I find most questionable, or that I would change, is just that choice of having the Doctor just floating in a starfield, and I would just change that for like have it him standing by the TARDIS console, and maybe because it was like a pickup that they were limited with access to sets, but then it would just mirror Donna sitting at the table, and it would be a nice setup for this like casual fourth wall breaking that's becoming a bit of a theme of this era, but. Mm. Where you've just got him sitting, like standing in this void. So I don't know sort of what to make of that. Is that like just it's not representing something literal. He's not sort of casually standing in space, is he? So like, what is it we're seeing?
I guess it's maybe sort of saying here's somebody, of the stars, I guess, even though we're not seeing stars, we're just seeing void, and here's somebody very much within earthbound existence, and the two are going to come together. But it doesn't, it doesn't quite mesh in the way maybe it could. The other thing that sort of looks a bit janky, I think unavoidably, is just the how would you say it? The resolution of a picture these days on TV is so immaculate that when they throw in these things from these quick, very quick clips from, you know, Donna's original
the flashbacks. Time,
it kind of looks a bit unavoidably grainy by comparison when you're seeing them at such close quarters. But it's so blinking you miss it. It probably only jumps out to the fans more than the casual viewer, I think, that stuff.
But then coming on to the main part of the story, so we talked about the aspects around adaptation, we talked about the intro, we talked about like our expectations going in. What did you make of it as an episode of Doctor Who?
I really enjoyed it. It's not my favourite of the three. Might be my second favourite. But it's... It does a great job of just... It comes back with real energy. There's the Doctor. He's kind of he's the 14th Doctor. He's not the 10th, right? You know, and they kind of show you quite some little subtle differences there early on in how he's conducting himself. He's more low key. He certainly looks older. He can be a little bit more reserved, and he has slightly different attitudes and takes and things. And yet there are familiar catchphrases and modes of behavior there too. So it's an interesting hybrid of a thing. And you know, just it just seems to flow beautifully from that moment where he lands, and then suddenly you're into those beautiful nighttime scenes in Camden. You've got Donna there. You're very quickly introduced to the family. When the meat shows up, it's just really good fun from there, because it's the meep's so well voiced by Miriam Margolyes, and Donna's comedy timing around all of that realization that it's not a toy and all that is so good. I love the stuff. There's my favorite moment, and it's jumping right to the end, really, is just that bit where the Doctor, you know, the realization has been dawning between with Donna that the Doctor has some significance in her life, and they find themselves just in it's that sort of almost it's almost an echo of Bernard Cribbins of the Four Knocks scenario, trapped between the glass. There they are on either side of this bifurcated control room, and he has no choice but to get her involved and become the Dr. Donna again. And it's just that moment when he starts to recite those that little sequence of words that are just total non sequiturs, but there's so much poetry in just the way it's done and delivered. And you know, Mexico, Andante, grief, you know, he the two of them just play that so beautifully, and it's and then to manage to tie that into the relatively arbitrary, I imagine at the time, binary thing, and then make it something much more of 2023 was genius to do that. I know some people like to roll their eyes at that, but then they'll roll their eyes at anything these days that even has the faintest hint of wokery, as they would call it, about it. But I just love that. The whole thing is just rolls along. It's got real energy to it. Rachel, it's an odd choice for Rachel Talalay to be the director for that, but maybe in hindsight, you'd have almost expected her to be picked as the director for Wild Blue Yonder, because it's much more of a high concept sci-fi thing. But actually, when you think about it, she grounds this very cartoonish thing in a bit more, I don't know, she just gives it weight and I don't know, balances the equilibrium of the whole thing really well.
Anyway, I guess she just knows, she knows Doctor Who, and she's like, she by that point she directed several episodes, so maybe it was this idea of like a safe pair of hands to relaunch this new era as well. But no, I agree, like everything you've said, and I think, like in particular, you said about it being like getting going and being, it's really tightly structured in the same way that Rose is. It's like, I feel like nothing's wasted, everything's there for a purpose. Continuity issues aside, I think the way it reuses the Meep story as this backdrop, but then also tells, like, you know, continues the story of the Doctor and Donna. It's all really, really good. Donna's daughter, I think I think she's really good in this episode. I'm a bit disappointed that when she came back at the end of season one, that we didn't see more of her. I felt she was a bit, and we'll get to that when we get to that episode, but I felt like she was a bit lost when she came back, and I was really looking forward to seeing more of her at that point. Yeah, Miriam Margolyes, like you said, was excellent, and I thought she was like a really good choice to do both sides of the Meep really well, like do that cute side and then do that transition to like, you know, Meep's true nature, and to do that without any kind of elaborate vocal effects, just do it mainly in the performance. And Sylvia was another highlight for me, that like recognizably the same character, but because she's obviously mellowed a bit in terms of how she is with Donna, because she was a little bit harsh and abrasive with her in series four. And then also with like being very sensitive about how she talks to or talks about Rose, it shows that it just feels like realistic, in that you could see how Sylvia from series four got to this point, how she's developed and grown a bit as a person.
Oh yeah, completely. Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think Sean's, you know, a really good character as well. He's so just accepting of everything. He's kind of just the guy you'd need in that situation. And he provides a fair wee bit of gentle comedy in it too. I just love that bit where he arrives home and there's just chaos going on in the kitchen, and
that tuna madras line.
Tuna madras moment. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Just that the comedy beats in that. Just everybody just is on point with that. With that. And it was incredible later to realize that house was the outside of that house was like a set inside studio. To me, like at the time, I just assumed it was outdoor shots, but it was really, really convincing that, you know, some of the stuff they do with the inside studio now like there's a huge difference from RTD1. Is like they were so much about, you know, their money saving technique in those days was to go out on location and you know, use a lot of steam and pipes in a factory to replicate a spaceship, and now they're building houses inside warehouses to say, look, there's an everyday house that we could have gone and filmed outdoors, but we've got more control of it here. So yeah, interesting.
I thought the production looked really good, like and like watching the behind the scenes stuff, you can see how much thought and effort they put into blending practical effects with CGI, and the big contrast that comes to my mind, like with things like the Meep and how they've got, you know, like a practical version and they've got like a CGI model, like the contrast with how the Slitheen were in their first story, where you had like, you know, a good costume and you had a CGI model, but just like the way they moved, the way they looked didn't really gel. Like, whereas here you don't notice the joins unless you watch the behind the scenes stuff. So yeah, I thought like just, and the same with the Wrath Warriors, like the set design costumes, you could see it had been elevated a little bit from where we were before. Although having said that, I've been seeing comments from them recently saying like there's never enough money, and that in the grand scheme of things, even with Disney support, Doctor Who is still relatively cheaper to make than other shows.
Yeah. You will almost certainly have listened to the same recent Radio Free Scarrow.
That was where it would be,
panel that from Gallifrey where
Stephen Moffat.
That bit where he says there are no cheap episodes. Like, believe me, there are no cheap, there's no such thing as a cheap episode. And also, yeah, Doctor Who should be getting more money than any other show, but it actually has always had less, and there's just never enough time, there's never enough money, and time is money and all that sort of thing. So I thought that was a really interesting perspective he brought. He said even, you know, like Boom, where you've really just got one set and one scenario, you have to do many more cuts and shots and all sorts of things and lighting things. And so the money...
Heaven Sent was the other one, I think you mentioned.
Yeah, so... anyway.
Right. And by the way, I really struggle to rank these three because, like, one of the things I was observing just rewatching them is that they are like a really expertly boiled down version of a Russell T. Davis season, where you've got your opener, you've got your weirder sci-fi episode, and then you've got your big splashy finale. And they're all, I think that all three of them are really successful at each of those things that they're trying to do. So in that sense, I find it hard to like rank them in order. I enjoy all of them. And on that topic, let's go on to Wild Blue Yonder, our second episode. And again, we have some like interesting continuity issues raised here, and also a lot of setup. So we have this thing about gravity and Mavity. We have Susan Twist appearing. We have a massive thing around the weakening of the walls of reality with the salt and all of that, that seems to have triggered this arc that's running through seasons one and two. And also we have looks back to the past. So we have the Timeless Child coming up as well, and I think being handled in a really interesting way. But yeah, what were your thoughts on Wild Blue Yonder?
Oh, I have so much to say about Wild Blue Yonder. I'll have to rein myself in a bit. It is my favourite of the three, and by some margin, I just absolutely love this thing. And it was the mysterious one, wasn't it? You know, when they first put the adverts together, and
it's, you know, very little in the trailer.
Titles, you know, I was like, oh, what are these titles going to be? And then it was the one that had like little redacted bits and stuff, and you were like, what is that? What's going on? And Russell did later say he worried that, you know, they were overselling the redacted nature of it, as though some big, you know, there was going to be some big returning villain there and everybody was going to be guessing what that was. And then when it turned out to be essentially a two-hander or a four-hander, depending on how you look at it, he was worried that it was going to be an anticlimax. But I think that was brilliant to do that, you know, just to keep it really mysterious. And so that when it was what it was, it just hits really hard and you're like, whoa, what the heck? You know, what is this? And the way the realization creeps in slow, that first moment where Tennant sort of slides down the wall and you just see something different in the body language. It's not quite there yet, but your brain's kind of going, this feels odd.
The slowness, that's the big thing in like the notes that I made that keeps coming up, is like how all of it, like the music and the character moments and the action, it builds and builds and builds and builds slowly until you get to that, like, the big horror moment of them being chased down the runway. But up until that point, it's like a very, very, and even like the sound design and the music. Because I noticed Murray Gold was doing something different from his normal style, and he was doing something I felt that was a bit more like what Sagan Akinola would do, that kind of atmospheric music using moments of silence to build up the tension. I totally get what you're saying there about that sort of ramping up of tension and uncomfortableness and weirdness in the first half.
He brings in this lovely sort of electronic palette to things early on. It's subtle, but it's there. And then there's this incredible moment where they send that kind of lonely probe out, you know, along the side of the ship and exploring the very edge of space, and there's a exquisitely melancholy piece of music that plays with that. It's just so, it's haunting, and it's, and the atmosphere, and that moment where the Doctor just leant right up against the glass, just almost daring it to break because he's so mesmerized by just being further than he's ever been. I love all that stuff. It's really sold so well. The only big kind of issue it's a tiny little issue on the audio front that I have is, the countdown initially is very hard to hear until the Doctor starts repeating the words. I couldn't hear at all what those words were, you know, Fenslaw and Collis and Brett, as it turns out, 3, 2, 1. But I guess he repeats them enough times in the episode to fix that issue. But it is hard to pull out of the sound mix.
Sound mix issues would be quite a sort of nostalgic RTD one touch.
Yeah, but I mean, there's you mentioned Mavity and stuff at the start there. That I love that just is there now. You know, that it's the butterfly effect, isn't it? Which we return to in Judy's first season. Be careful what you do in the past because you will affect the the future. But and I know that's a very Marmite thing, that Mavity thing. Some people just seem that it seems to make them grind their teeth, and then other people kind of enjoy it. I'm personally quite happy to just enjoy it for what it is.
Do you think it will ever be explained, or is that just going to be like an ongoing in joke that is just there?
I think it might just be an ongoing in joke. I think it's interesting that the first time it's repeated, the Doctor uses the word gravity, and Donna goes, "What?" And he goes, "I mean Mavity," which suggests that he, being the complex space-time event that he is, can hold both versions of history, altered and unaltered, in his head, which actually helps with some continuity things, maybe if you think of him that way. But that whole slowness conceit is brilliant. I love when Russell T. Davis does that sort of stuff, you know, where he comes up with that. It's like, I love the fact that the countdown is thrown in there really early. It's like stated in a list of five possibilities countdown, and that's exactly what it was, a slow countdown. But because it's given to you, but then you don't have time to think about it because so much else is going on the whole way through. And just incredibly creepy moments. The way, like, those two really shine, Tennant and Tate, because their counterparts are so creepy and eerie. And they go, sometimes they're standing there with a really low energy smirk, and then other times they're just like ferocious, you know, like animalistic in the way they're kind of spitting out questions. And love it, just absolutely love the whole thing. Oh, and then the bit at the end where the TARDIS is used like a hoverboard, that was just such a cool little innovation for me. I just think, like, yes, this is, even if that's, you know, okay, maybe Russell isn't going to come back and revolutionize every aspect of Doctor Who, but if he comes up with original image, 60 years in, we've never seen an image like the Doctor pushing the TARDIS along like a skateboard, like that's just brilliant. And somewhere along the line, that's popped into his head in the intervening years. He's gone, I have to get that on screen. I just love stuff like that. I'm really not. I know I'm going to go away after this and think about 50 other things I should have said because I love the story so much. But I'll let you talk for a bit. Sorry.
No. That's again, like, agree with all of that. Like the performances. Yeah, that range of like doing the sort of slightly off, slightly creepy, Uncanny Valley version, and then doing that ferocious animalistic one, and the, again, on that theme of it building and it building that sense of unease and wrongness in the first half, it doesn't take you long to work out that these are duplicates, because, you know, it's shot in a way that you're seeing two sets of the Doctor and Donna, so it's kind of quite an obvious clue. But the way the performances just make you feel like really unsettled, and the fact that the TARDIS isn't there as well, that adds to it as well, like that's just lost at the start, and it makes you think of like classic stories, like, is it Mind Robber or Frontios or where the TARDIS is lost or destroyed, or The Impossible Planet, which I think this has like some things in common with as well. And like when that sort of like touchstone of safety is gone, it just sort of says, like, you know, all the rules are up in the air in terms of like you know, threats and stakes and things. And the ending, it's got this, so this, I think this story's got elements of Impossible Planet and also elements of Midnight, but it also has a lot of that money on show in terms of spectacle, and when it does explode, you have these like big ambitiously staged moments. And the ending, like, there's that decision, I think, that generated a lot of discussion about the Doctor choosing the wrong Donna at the end and then going back and correcting his mistake. But I think that's realistic, because if you're dealing with someone who is a duplicate, then, you know, no matter how well you know that person, that there is the chance that you would make a mistake. And it's like, it's quite a classic Doctor thing to be fallible and then to like fix the mistake in the nick of time.
Yeah. And it's also, it is that thing of, when I was first watching that, I thought, yes, that obviously is the right Donna, because that feels televisually like the right answer to give in that moment. It's funny because it just is, right? And that's supposed to be the thing that's human. But what's equally human, as the Doctor pointed out earlier in the story, is contradiction. And sometimes you could just give the crappier answer, you know? And for her life to depend on that, you know, it was quite something. You know, it was a real shocker of a decision, like, or you know, a risk, a gamble. But there are moments, by the way, in this episode, I don't want it to go out of my head and not say these. There are two beautiful speeches, and they're kind of given as counterpointing sort of speeches when each of the doctors, when Donna and the Doctor are each first encountering, without realizing they have counterparts, their counterparts. And Donna's one is to talk about, you know, this business of, you know, they'll come back and they'll visit the alleyway over days. And, you know, Sean will continue to come for his, he'll never give up coming back to the alleyway. And her grandfather would come back and all this stuff. And it's really beautifully done. And it's so melancholy. But the other one, the one that really grabbed me was the Doctor talking about him, how he wonders what happens to the TARDIS when it does go into its hostile action displacement mode. He has this whole beautiful romantic scenario in his head about how the TARDIS goes and perches itself on a clifftop somewhere, and then over generations cities come and go around it, and then finally all that fades away and all that's left is just the TARDIS sitting right you know, centuries in, and then it comes back to find him again. And when I saw the trailer for the 2024 season, I saw that shot of the TARDIS on the clifftop with, you know, covered in moss and lichen and all that stuff, and I thought, oh, they're actually doing that. That idea was such a, he was seeding that idea, and they're actually going to do that for real, which they didn't quite do in the way he, you know, projected there, but it sort of echoed that, and I thought that was really interesting. But yeah, so I suppose I better wrap up my thoughts on this, or we'd be talking all night. but you're right, that thing he does with the salt seems to be absolutely crucial, because that's the moment, isn't it? That's the moment where what Russell T. Davies is going to do this time around with Doctor Who, the doors are thrown wide open, because it's like, okay, in order to give maximum room for manoeuvring about in the ever evolving zeitgeist here, we can do magic, we can do, you know, godlike powers, we can do things that Doctor Who could sort of lean into, but never as fully lean into before. And now we're not, it's the scale that's different, you know, and the room to really stretch the elastic on that.
And it gives us like an in-universe explanation for like stylistic changes, like just like unexplained fourth wall breaking, or just use of music, and like you can kind of cover it with this thing of like, well, the laws of the universe have changed. Because of this,
but the Doctor says, I thought that was diegetic. You know, it kind of makes a sort of sense. Yeah, in a way that it might not have done before. Yeah, that kind of thing.
We should move on to the giggle. But just like one more thing I wanted to touch on quickly was the timeless child, because I thought it was like quite a gracious thing on Russell T. Davies' part, but also a really interesting thing, the way that they mention that. And I think the way that they build on it in quite an emotionally rich way. So he's not just doing like a continuity reference to say, yes, the timeless child happened. He's using it in this really key emotional moment of the fake Donna trying to break down the Doctor by using it as a like a fundamental vulnerable point to have a go with, and that has carried forward into season one. And I think it's really interesting to think about that theme of you know, adoption and identity and all of that sort of stuff that the timeless child brings up beyond all the sci-fi stuff about the origins of the Time Lords.
And that's right. And I'm glad you brought that up, because that sort of ties in again with that sort of anticipatory period that we had when people were speculating what Russell T. Davies was going to do. And a lot of people said, look, see that timeless child stuff? He'll not address that. he'll put that to one side and never talk about it again because it was a failed experiment and this and that. And in the end, he was actually incredibly generous in what he did. He said, no, I'll take the best of that. I'll take its emotional resonance and you know, as you said, and really kind of tease it out and make something even more of it. That has even further aspects down the road with Nchiri and the church and Ruby Road and moments like that. He'll talk even more explicitly and very, you know, to him, that's such a raw and recent revelation about his own adoption and so on that it makes the show new again because it's like we didn't know these things, but they somehow feel more. And this isn't. I don't mean this to be a big criticism of Chibnall. He just seeded it in a softer way and then didn't maybe use it to its fullest potential. Whereas Russell T. Davies is now sort of saying, "Well, what? How would that feel? You know, like how would that sit with the Doctor, and how does it affect how he engages with people and all that sort of thing?" So it's it's really interesting.
Yeah, and. And I said that was the last thing, but like one more thing we should acknowledge is like this is the most significant amount of Bernard Cribbins that we get like right at the end of this episode.
Yeah. I thought you were going to say the most significant amount of CGI, but because that set is amazing. Some people say it looks cheap. I think it looks amazing, but yes, Bernard at the end there, he is he gets a really lovely scene, just a lovely bookend to his time on the show. It's such a shame that at the start of the giggle, it's so clearly not him, and they're having to really just like work around the fact that he had died or was too ill to continue. And
I don't know what else they could have done.
No, it's one of those unavoidable things, but you still look at it and go, oh, that's not, you know, it feels so flimsy compared to what we had of him in the episode before, and that's a shame. But at least he got one final. Hurrah, and a dedication.
I think the awkwardness of that bit at the start of the giggle is worth putting in like the material that they did have with him at the end of World Beyonder. I wouldn't want to have lost that for the sake of avoiding that
100%
that cover.
Yeah.
But let's come on to the giggle then. I mean, like I said, I feel like these three episodes do a really good job of like replicating the beginning, middle, and end of a longer season, and the giggle for me felt like a two-part finale squashed down into one episode in terms of how much happens. It's kind of got that feature film or feature length ambition and scale to it with lots of different locations and stakes and things, and we'll talk about as well about like the stuff at the end, which I think again was the thing that was most focused on in discussion. But before we get on to Bi-Generation and all of that sort of stuff, what were your thoughts about the story as a whole?
I liked it. I'd find myself in this position, which I sometimes do, and you'll understand this as a hardcore fan as well. A thing had gone online which purported to be the basically the sort of storyline, you know, a synopsis of the overall storyline. I read this thing at my own risk and found on watching it that much of it turned out to be true. Now that didn't ruin the viewing experience for me because I can handle that, you know, like I say, it was my decision, and the telling, you know, the actual experience of how it's done is always somewhat different to what you pictured in your head when you saw the bullet points anyway. But yeah, so I had that thing where Wild Blue Honor had been the one that blew me away with just the unknown, right? Absolutely captivating me. Star Beast had been familiar. The Giggle was familiar for different reasons, but that was my own self-inflicted fault. But I thought it was a really good, solid way to end that trilogy of the 14th Doctor. And the Toymaker returning was, well, like, it's just one of those things you just couldn't have anticipated being the case. And then suddenly it's like, yeah, of course it does make sense. Because if we're in this new era of there can be godlike beings, he would be one of the the most powerful ones to come back. The stuff I really like most is kind of the bits around the bi-generation at the end, and that whole bit of where the doctor becomes his own therapist and everything, all that stuff is where it really culminates into something transcendent for me. And before that, it's kind of in a strange way, the opening, say, 15 to 20 minutes feels most like Russell T. Davis 2 impersonating RTD1. That's where it feels like it's like, oh, we are in a bit of a retread here, but I guess it's more forgivable in this context of the 60th anniversary, sort of playing familiar tropes. But I'm still not sure what to think of the massive new unit headquarters. It works really well for that final scene with the big laser gun and everything. But yeah, this big sort of Sky Palace thing that they're in, I don't know what I think of that set or the setup. That bit where I love the fact that when he first encounters Mel, he's almost walked right past her before he twigs who he's just spoken to. It's this lovely moment of, because the doctor could be he's such a genius, but he can be so clueless in the moment too, where he's just like, it takes him 30 seconds to go, was I just speaking to Melanie Bush? It's like, I love moments like that that really kind of break the tension, and RTD is really good at just putting those in at exactly the right moments to sort of just make the thing sing a wee bit more,
And the new setup for UNIT is interesting, and I feel like, because Russell T. Davis has talked about this like before he came back, about how Doctor Who should be aping the Marvel Studios model, and it felt maybe a bit on the nose to like evoke Avengers Tower so much with that unit building. But I think in isolation it looks really good. I like the new unit setup. I think Kate is used in a really effective way in this episode. And actually, related to that, one of her best moments is, I really like just the concept of the giggle, this idea that it's tapping into like modern issues around paranoia and anger and disinformation and fake news and all of this. It was very topical, but also we mentioned Years and Years at the start. I felt it was like pulling on exactly those sorts of themes about like politics and division and the dynamics of that. And then the way that is connected to Kate is like, she's used an example of like what happens if you take that inhibitor off. And that was a really sort of effective way of saying, look, like, even good people or people that you like are not invulnerable to this disease of like anger and division.
Yeah.
So
we're sort of and peak that right now, aren't we? In 2025. It feels even kind of it does have that Years and Years thing of saying like, how much worse can it get? Well, yeah. Things begin to seem less science fiction-y and more, oh my God, that was just around the corner.
I agree with you. Like the bi-generation stuff and the therapy stuff at the end, that's the bit that I like think of first and that I find most compelling. But I think the rest of the story is really good as well. I think Neil Patrick Harris is really, really strong with the quite different reinterpretation of the Toymaker. Like I said, it's got that sort of ambition, and you can see the money with the special effects and the number of locations, and I think it's a really solid finale that then has this, and this is like one of the things I was thinking about looking back on it is that this is like, and actually I think I thought this at the time, that it's kind of a really nice coda to the whole of the Doctor story up until that point, because you have this bi-generation, you have one Doctor who goes off to just have a happy ending, and you have another Doctor who carries on. And that moment when he's sitting around the table with Donna and her family, that feels like in another world it could be the last ever scene of the TV series, that it's not this like overly dramatic final battle with the Daleks and death. It's just this, what is the line? He says, I've never been so happy in my life. And that's, I think everything that got to that point in those last few scenes was really incredible.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. Although it does, I've been thinking, you know, obviously since broadcast, I've been thinking, how does it actually work? Because Inshuti arrives and he's like, okay, I already have the benefits of your therapy intrinsically in me. So when Tennant shuffles off his mortal coil, as it were, does he just get reabsorbed sort of somehow back?
It's really vague.
Into the regeneration?
I had the same question in my notes. Does the 14th Doctor loop back and get absorbed back in? Because, okay, so there's a couple of things that imply that. The fact that the 15th Doctor can just fly off, it suggests that he has, in his own personal past, had that therapy and time to rest and heal. Mm. And also, and I don't know if this is just like vague phrasing, but Donna has a line where she says, he's younger because you came after him. So, again, that implies that the 15th Doctor is actually older than the bi-generated 14th.
Yeah, yeah.
Because
I think that is supporting evidence. I'm not completely convinced.
It's ambiguous.
What I mean to say is that that's definitely the way it would... That's the only way it can work by logical deduction. I'm not completely sure if Russell T. Davis has thought that through in exactly that way. I'd like to think so, but I'm beginning on occasion to wonder, does he cross all the I's and dot all the T's on this stuff?
He said some very confusing things at the time, I remember, because he was, and this might have just been like hyperbole and just like getting carried away in that, again, that thing of like engaging really well with the press. But I remember him saying things about, oh yeah, it's retrospective and there's all these like bi-generated classic doctors out there. And on one level, that's quite a lovely idea because you could have like those classic doctors coming back to film new stories. And it doesn't matter that they look older because it's the bi-generated version. But then also it raises like a million questions and it doesn't answer that central question of like, yeah, does the 14th Doctor loop back into the 15th when he dies, or does he continue off as a separate branch and you end up with like infinite doctors because you're just doubling?
Yeah, does Tom Baker really get up and just wander off into the dark dimension or something? I don't know. But and also it kind of, maybe if I think about this with, you know, over a longer time, I'll become more accepting of it, but it slightly cheapens the idea of, you know, you have your doctor and then that doctor, like death does claim a part of the doctor each time, you know, that the emotional impact of that doctor dying and regenerating is you will never see them again. You know, it's they've had their time and there isn't this sort of bonus version sort of thing.
Does the bonus version bi-generate again as well, or is, do they have a different status from the main version or the new version?
I don't know. I love talking of doubling up, though. I love that thing with the mallet, just creating, you know, you get a prize, honey, and then the second TARDIS and all that. Love it. Absolutely love it. It's such a Russell T. Davis idea. You can just see, I think he's a very visual thinker sometimes, you know, before he puts words to the keyboard, he just has this... Mm. He'll see something like that in his head and the kinetic energy of it. He's like, right, I've got that. He'll have drawn it before he's written it. You know what I mean? And it's one of those. And I just thought that that really worked so well on screen. So, yeah. And then just that parting of the ways of the two doctors. And I guess by implication in the looping back to become. Presumably the 14th doctor. Presumably the 14th Doctor's TARDIS has kind of a limiter on it where it knows to take him only to the non-problematic places. Do you know what I mean? Like he's no longer the cosmic player. He's the guy that nips off to New York for the weekend and does a bit of shopping and it's nice.
Am I imagining it, or was there some comment, like some behind the scenes comment about the significance of which is the original TARDIS and which is the copy and how that will come back at some point? Or was that like fan discussion?
Watch this space.
Well, that's the other thing. Like, you know, we have these completely unsubstantiated, unconfirmed rumors that Nshuti is leaving. But then that raises the question, if that is true, is David Tennant going to pop back in to close that loop or resolve that plot thread? Or are we just never going to see David Tennant's 14th Doctor again?
I think if you're going to repeat that thing, yes, David Tennant was the right, exactly the right guy to guarantee the bums on seats and all that for the 60th. And he deserved his lap of honour and all the rest of it before taking a plunge into the new stuff. But I think if you were going to have to, and in this case it would be a contingency plan rather than a sort of a celebratory thing, to fill a void between while they work out what to do next, I think you would go for, you'd bring back Matt Smith, wouldn't you? Or you, do you know what I mean?
Go for that. The obvious choice. that's interesting in itself. But my thought was more about like closing the loop on like something of like, the 15th regenerates into the 16th, but in that process of that happening, somehow the 14th is involved and I don't know how it would work. But yeah, that's another really interesting question. Like if there was like a transition period again. Yeah, I agree. But Matt Smith.
The fact that they've supposedly unlocked a finale to do a significant reshoot suggests something. Has, whether it's, you know, maybe a lot of dramatic deductions could be made, and I'm not saying that Nshuti hasn't sort of said like I've waited long enough and have to get on with my career, but it could be just, you know, Disney had some notes and those notes take time to film.
All right. It's and as I say, it's all speculation at the moment, but interesting. Some interesting speculation.
Oh, one final. I love the 15th Doctor's theme that gets introduced. I think that's maybe my favorite Doctor theme that's been introduced since the series came back. I just absolutely adore that piece of music that is now his iconic leitmotif or whatever you'd call it. It's so good. It fits him spot on. It feels like,
and we don't get
chaos or something. It's really good.
And we don't get loads of him, but I feel like we get enough to get a good sense of who he is. And obviously that gets picked up in the next Christmas special in season one. But I thought they did a good job of, because it's a delicate balancing act to not overshadow your brand new Doctor by overlapping so much with David Tennant. Mm. But I think they pulled it off. Let's do some final looking back then. I think we've talked a bit already about like how we've sort of thought about this stuff and how our views on some stuff might have changed. But anything more you wanted to say on that? And also like how well did these three specials work as a celebration of the 60th anniversary? Because I've got some thoughts on this, that basically Power of the Doctor, I think, is a better anniversary celebration, even though it was a year early. But what are your thoughts?
Yeah, do these work? Notionally, ironically, it was the 100th anniversary of the BBC celebration, wasn't it? And it might have been the one where Stooky Bill could have been more appropriately put in.
Yeah.
But although I suppose we haven't yet reached 100, well, it'll be this year, won't it? 125 years of televisual stuff from the BBC. But I see what you're saying. And to some extent, you're right. But I do think that if one doesn't want to be too backward looking, even in celebrating. So it's kind of like, here's David Tennant taking a bow, but he's not the 10th Doctor, he's the 14th Doctor. So there's the new, the old, it's all mixed together. There's a feeling of this show has energy left in it. It's creative. Tanks are not empty. They're very far from empty. And there's a little balance between celebrating the things you know and moving on from the things you know. And I thought that was pretty perfectly judged. It's kind of a bit like when Big Finish did Zagreus instead of, The Light at the End or something. It's more that kind of vibe when you want to kind of go, let's not do too much of what we've done before. Let's give it a a flavor of the now as well. I suppose it's RTD coming back and giving more of a spotlight to his era than Doctor Who overall is as a 60-year thing. But he's not doing that, because he's, you know, William Hartnell actually appears in there, and we've got things like that. So it's a pretty balance for anyone, yeah.
Because the whole thrust of these three specials was wrapping up Donna's story, and or one big thrust of it was. So in that sense, it's like it isn't covering the whole history of the show, and it's just picking up on that one particular very important thread. But actually, the thing that we were talking about before, about how it's this kind of like, you know, really nice happy ending for the Doctor, I think that's one way that you can tie it back to being a celebration of the whole show, that it's like a full stop or a coda to the whole 60-year story that we've had so far.
Yeah, I think that was a really nice thing you said about it. Could literally, that scene with Tennant around the table with Mad Auntie Mel and all those ones could really just genuinely be where it all stops, you know, and it would feel nice. It would just be a nice, a nice thing to do. But one other wee thing I was just going to say, in terms of, you know, and how anticipation ultimately resolved in, you know, what's the kind of retrospective feeling about how it turned out. This is going to maybe seem like an odd thing to pull in at this point, but there's a sort of a long running thing on YouTube where every so often somebody will put together a little Red Dwarf titles version of the Doctor Who, of a particular Doctor Who season, you know, with the little clips, you know, put to the Red Dwarf music. And some of those work better than others, but one of the best ones I've seen, maybe the best one I've seen is there's one for Nshuti season and there's one for these specials, and the imagery in those just somehow seems to fit perfectly. There's something big and cartoonish and bold, and the spaceships feel cavernous, but also there's little studio bound bits, and something about the feel of it feels, you know, like, I don't know, it's a universe in which you wouldn't be surprised to see Starbug turn up in or something, you know. It's that kind of vibe, and so I just wanted to throw that in, because I'm not sure how to describe the overall vibe of what we've had, and there's a full, you know, further 8 episodes of Nshuti in the tank to really get the overall flavor of it. But some of the big swings in it feel really like, yeah, you know, you can absolutely imagine a Red Dwarf season where, you know, the clip it goes between like doppelgangers looking at each other and then somebody being sucked into a musical instrument, or you know, the meat being poked in the eye and reacting with a big flourish. You know, do you know what I mean? It feels, when you see it done like that, it's like, yeah, that there's a particular flavor to it that's kind of freewheeling and fun. But also, you know, it's still got deep emotional heart to it, and there's big stuff going on. And actually, just, I know this is sort of retreading back into the giggle, but I meant to say, I love the thing about how the toy maker, he wasn't just into games as games, he was into the games of ghosting and, you know, mind games and all the things that people do to each other in the modern era. I meant to mention that at the time, because those things are so damaging. I know we talked about the more political side of it, but as I say, I think a lot of the modern zeitgeist has already been captured pretty well by Russell in that very concise, you know, way that he does. He's able to throw out a phrase and cover a lot of ground.
I think all that stuff about like taking big swings and interesting ideas, I think we can totally come back to that next week when we start talking about season one, because there's definitely lots of those in there. I think we'll leave it there for this week, but there's a load of stuff I think we can pick up when we start looking at Church on Ruby Road and the first half of season one in next week's podcast. I think one of the things that I was thinking about is like, where would you tell a new viewer to jump on? Would it be the Star Beast? Would it be Church on Ruby Road, or would it be Space Babies? And maybe we can have a discussion about the arguments for and against each of those. Or would you tell them to go back and watch you know, some of the classic series first? But we'll leave it there for this week. And I'll say thank you, Mark, for joining me.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Yeah, no, it's been really good. I think having that distance to like reflect on how we feel about this stuff, and because I think your views on things can change over time, as well as like when you get the context of what's come since as well. And thank you to everyone for listening, and we will see you next week.